From the studios of WRPI in Troy, New York, this is Little Brother, the show where we talk about high technology, low intelligence, what happens when you mix the two, and we're like any other responsible little brother, we tell on Big Brother. My name is Chuck Ritter, and I'll be your host for the next hour and a half, I think it is, as we explore this world of the high tech. This is episode number 38, I think, last time I checked, of Little Brother. I think it's 38, isn't it?
I believe so.
Yeah. Dated for the 23rd of March, 2002. Stay tuned, Little Brother's right around the corner. And you are listening to Little Brother on WRPI in Troy. And before we get started, we need to remind you that the opinions and views expressed in this show are strictly those of the participants and not necessarily those of the Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, Rensselaer Student Union, or the WRPI staff or management. Responsible parties with an opposing viewpoint may request airtime for rebuttal. And if you'd like to throw in your 2 cents worth, please feel free to do so. You can reach us here at WRPI by dialing 518-276-6248. That number again is 518-276-6248. Or you can send email. The email address is critter@verizoneatspoop.com. That address again, critter, C-R-I-T-T-E-R, at verizoneatspoop, all one word, .com. And last but not least, you can send us snail mail. The snail mail address is Chuck Ritter, Box 31, WRPI, 1 WRPI Plaza, Troy, New York, 12180. Or if that doesn't sound quite right, you can juggle the terms a little bit, and it'll eventually make its way to me. So, let's get started. What have you got?
Well, let's see. I am Fungaboo, by the way. And you have returned from America's Heartland, I believe.
Yes, I have.
How was your time out there?
I just came from Tulsa, and it was a good time. Aside from the air travel was a little bit tedious.
A little frisky?
for lack of a better description, you know, I mean, there's a risk all of its own right here. we had this fun little thing happen while we were down there. Let me bring this music down a little bit. We remastered the music, so it's a little bit punchier and it's a little frisky. So anyway, like I was saying, the flight was supposed to go from Albany to Detroit to Memphis to Tulsa, and we got to Detroit and they couldn't find the crew for the plane. And then they went and they found the crew, and then they had to clean the plane, which they hadn't done yet. Of course, I don't know why they didn't do that while they were out looking for the crew.
Did they get the chicken coops out of there before it went in? Or?
And then we got they got it cleaned up, and then they got everybody on board. Oh, I forgot. They couldn't find the ticket taker. The ticket taker just didn't show up for work that day. They had a supervisor come over, and boy, was she in a foul mood, which is entertaining all in and of itself.
Hmm.
And then
sounds really reassuring.
Here's where it gets really good, though, is after they got everybody on the plane, we're sitting there, we're waiting, we're starting to wonder what the heck's going on, and the captain comes on the PA system, and he says,
is there an electrician in the house?
Oh, no.
I kid you not. They were looking to see if there was an electrician because the guy that drove the baggage cart crashed into the jetway and severed the power cord to the jetway so they couldn't pull the jetway away from the plane.
Oh, no.
And there we sat for an hour and a half while they fixed the damn thing. We couldn't get on or off the plane because they'd already secured the cabin and all that other fun stuff. And
but MacGyver happened to be on the flight, right? And he jumped right up, and he used like a bubble gum wrapper and some bubble gum to patch the cord together.
I don't know. They called over 3 or 4 supervisors, and finally they decided, yes, actually, you know, the peon had a good idea. You really can push the jetway away with one of the tractors that you push the plane out with.
But that would have been great if one of the passengers got off. Yeah, I'm an electrician. Can you help us? I'm union. I'm off duty. I'm sorry.
Ouch, that would have hurt. But yeah, actually, I'll tell you something. I was actually impressed by the area down there. And believe it or not, I think I have drawn the conclusion that Tulsa is actually a step up from the Capital District.
Really?
Really.
And how do you figure that?
It felt like the first of all, obviously the people were friendlier. This is still frontier country to a certain extent.
Mm-hmm.
But the amenities that they had there, they have apparently one of the best phone systems in the country in that immediate area.
Really?
Yeah. Go figure. Apparently, it's like the secondary test area after New Jersey.
Can you elaborate on that?
They get all of the leading-edge technology. They get DSL that actually works.
Wow. And does it get installed in less than 4 months?
It does. It does, indeed. They've got a cable ISP down there that apparently provides service that's faster than Roadrunner is.
Wow.
Yeah. And that's hard to fathom, I know. Anyway.
So sounds like if your plans are still in order, you'll be making a step up. Oh, no.
No. That's not for public disclosure.
Oh.
Yeah.
So speaking of airport staff getting frisky, I guess in this case, the question would be, is there a cyborg in the house? And the answer would have been yes in Toronto's St. John House. And the answer would have been yes in Toronto's St. John's International Airport. This comes from the New York Times. Steve Mann, an engineering professor at the University of Toronto, has lived as a cyborg for more than 20 years, wearing a web of wires, computers, and electronic sensors that are designed to augment his memory, enhance his vision, keep tabs on his vital signs. Although his wearable computer system sometimes elicited stares, he never encountered any problems going through the security gates at airports. Last month, that changed. Before boarding a Toronto-bound plane at he was in Newfoundland, going to Toronto. Boarding a Toronto-bound plane at St. John's International Airport in Newfoundland, Dr. Mann says he went through a three-day ordeal in which he was ultimately strip-searched and injured by security personnel. During the incident, he said $56,800 worth of his $500,000 equipment was lost or damaged beyond repair, including the eyeglasses that serve as his display screen. His lawyer in Toronto sent letters 2 weeks ago to Air Canada, the airport, and the Canadian Transportation Authority, arguing that they acted negligently and seeking reimbursement for the damaged equipment so that Dr. Mann could put his wearable computer back together again. The difficulties that Dr. Mann faced seemed related to the tightening of security in airports since the terrorist attacks of September 11th, but he had flown from Toronto to St. John's 2 days earlier without a hitch. On that day, February 16th, he said he followed the routine he has used on previous flights. He told the security guards in Toronto that he had already notified the airline about his equipment. He showed them documentation, some of it signed by his doctor, that described the wires and glasses which he wears every waking minute as part of his internationally renowned research on wearable computers. He also asked for permission not to put his computer through the X-ray machine because the device is more sensitive than a laptop. He said that the guards examined his equipment and allowed him to board the flight. But when he tried to board his return flight on February 18th, his experience was entirely different. This time, he said he was told to turn his computer on and off and put it through the X-ray machine. He took his case to Neil Campbell, Air Canada's customer service manager at the St. John's Airport, and spent the next 2 days arranging conversations between his university colleagues and the airline. The security guards continued to require that he turn his machine on and off and put it through the X-ray machine while also tugging on his wires and electrodes, he said. Still not satisfied, the guards took him to a private room for a strip search in which he said the electrodes were torn from his skin, causing bleeding, and several pieces of equipment were strewn about the room. Once his system was turned on again, X-rayed and dismantled, Dr. Mann passed through the security check. When he was finally allowed to go home, some pieces of equipment were not returned to him, he said, and his glasses were put in the plane's baggage compartment, although he warned that cold temperatures there could ruin them. So basically, we essentially have our first case of cyborg discrimination.
I would say that's what this sounds like. Although, up until this point, I would never have thought that cyborgs were a social class. I suppose you could kind of make an argument for it to a certain extent. I mean, you've seen the way I wander around with a 2-meter ham radio strapped to my belt, which of course I'm not wearing today. But you see the 2-meter radio strapped to my belt with a mic up here on the lapel and the cell phone and all the other gadgets that I carry. So I can kind of see the point, but for them to actually rip something out that had been surgically implanted, that's inexcusable.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's arguable. His cyborg status is somewhat, like, I guess, semantically arguable, because my understanding is his equipment doesn't really have two-way feedback with his brain. It's merely monitoring equipment and such. I don't know much more about it, but
well, even so, you know what scares me about this particular case is it's what would happen if one of the devices that he was wearing was medically necessary.
Mm-hmm. That's my understanding.
Were some of them?
Yes.
Oh,
yeah.
So
and
they,
I mean,
they
he had, like they said, he had. I don't know the full nature of that. You know what their purposes are, but like they said, his doctor had provided, some notation that they were necessary.
That I think you could make an argument they threatened his life. Then
it almost reminds me of an attack that happened on my friend where a intravenous diabetic pump some attackers tried to steal this from my friend, thinking it was a pager.
Yes, I know.
So
I know the one you're talking about.
It's almost a similar situation,
Yeah.
Where you're having this device that is needed either for your health or for your survival being ripped out. His lawyer was quoted as saying, basically, we were going to argue Professor Mann was discriminated against because he is a cyborg. You can laugh at that, but I don't see the difference between showing up at the airport in a wearable computer and showing up in a wheelchair. So they're really pushing this fact.
It sounds that way.
And he summed up by saying, my client is a cyborg, not a terrorist.
And to the... I'm sure that his parting words were, I'll be back.
Apparently it's a big week. the new Terminator in the next Terminator movie is a leggy supermodel.
Oh yeah, which one?
I don't know.
Oh,
I'm not familiar with her. I read the name but didn't ring a bell. But nonetheless, far cry from what's that guy's name? He's on the X-Files now. You know who I'm talking about. He replaced Mulder.
Oh, yeah, him.
Patrick.
Okay. Yes.
Robert Patrick. Seems to be a big week for cyborgs this week.
Why, what else have you got?
Well, here's another story which kind of, I guess, fuels the question of whether Mr. Mann is a full-fledged cyborg. Because I guess this week, the first full-fledged human cyborg with, two-way equipment integrated into the nervous system was created. A British university professor has been fitted with cyborg technology enabling his nervous system to be linked to a computer. So we almost have, like, input and output. The groundbreaking surgery on Professor Kevin Warwick effectively makes him the world's first cyborg. Part human, part machine. Although a long way from fictional characters such as the Terminator or the $6 Million Man, it is hoped that readings will be taken from the implant in his arm of electrical impulses coursing through his nerves. These signals encoding movements like wiggling fingers and feelings like shock and pain will be transmitted to a computer and recorded for the first time. So that's pretty much a precedent, I would say. At least
in
a human.
It certainly is. Mm-hmm. I know that... some years ago, I had read an article, and I wish I could pin it down, because I've not been able to pin it down since. I swear I was wide awake, and stone cold sober when I read this, but it was that British Telecom had been working on something similar to this, recording brain impulses.
Mm.
Now, to what extent they were recording them, I don't know, but...
Well, they go on to mention that similar experiments have previously only ever been carried out on cats and monkeys in the United States. And I do recall from last year the groundbreaking experiment where they actually got to... They recreated the vision of a cat by tapping into the optical nerves of a feline and reproduced it on a television screen.
Now, that's entertaining.
Especially when you make the cat look at the TV screen.
Oh, that's got to mess with the that's got to mess with the cat's brain, though.
When you have a feedback loop going through your synapses, I think your head explodes. You know, like when you're doing a mic check and you hear that squeal going on, imagine that happening in your brain.
Right. I suppose the question there would be, what did they? Well, I don't know. The thing I'm curious about is how much does feline vision differ from human? Because that would be an interesting
thing. I saw some pictures of it. They were pretty fuzzy black and white, but I don't know if that was the nature of their ability to kind of reorganize the impulses from the nerves, or whether that's really only how good a cat sees. One will never know.
But I'd have to assume they see better than that. I mean, I know that they...
It kind of looked like a Fisher Price PXL 2000.
I know there's only a few species roaming the planet that can see in color. We're one of them, and I always get lost on what the other one is. I want to say it's either some variety of pig or some variety of monkey, but I really couldn't tell you what.
Cat vision is monochromatic, though.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. Just about every species is.
So continuing on about this new cyborg. Surgeons implanted a silicon square about three. You know what my mind is.
Yeah, we got cats getting silicone implants now.
You know what's on my mind. Surgeons implanted a silicon square about 3 millimeters wide into an incision in Warwick's left wrist and attached its 100 electrodes, each as thin as a hair, into the median nerve. Connecting wires were fed under the skin of the forearm and out from a skin puncture, and the wounds were sewn up. The wires will be linked to a transmitter-receiver device to relay nerve messages to a computer by radio signal. It is possible that the procedure could lead to a medical breakthrough for people paralyzed by spinal cord damage, such as Superman actor Christopher Reeve. On Friday, Warwick denied claims that the surgery, which was carried out by the Radcliffe Infirmary in Oxford, England, was just a publicity stunt. Quote, to go through a 2-hour operation, I would say, is a little bit extreme for a publicity stunt, unquote, he told the BBC. Quote, to say, no, you can't do this, or that this is a publicity stunt, is absolutely crazy at this stage, when we haven't even looked into it, unquote. He said the £500,000, that's $715,000, experiment was about seriously...
Yeah, I hope it doesn't weigh that much.
It's almost like Harrison Bergeron. Then. Seriously helping people with spinal injuries. He added, this has not been done on a human before, so for someone to say this is not going to tell us much, we don't know. We really don't know, but we want to find out what sort of signals we are going to get and what sort of signals we can put in. Researchers at the university's Department of Cybernetics will carry out experiments on Warwick for about a month. He said, quote, what we are doing is historic and monumentous. It is going to change the world. Science fiction has predicted this for quite some time, and as a scientist, I'm excited about taking a step into the future. But as a human, I do share the ethical concern about what it will mean for humanity. Warwick also hopes to wire himself to an ultrasonic sensor used by robots to navigate around objects to give him a bat-like sixth sense. So he's almost pushing outside the box a bit. He believes the technique could be developed within a decade to restore movement to a tetraplegic's hand or a feeling to a prosthetic leg used by an amputee. Quote, for someone like Christopher Reeve, it might not bring back complex movement, but if it could allow him to control a bit of technology to pick up a cup, it would be enormously useful. Warwick has already been a guinea pig for his own experiments. In 1998, a silicon chip which turned on lights and opened doors when he walked into his office was implanted in his arm. So he's, I guess he's so lazy, he doesn't even want to bother with the clapper. It's like too much effort for him.
Or something like that. Oh, wow. That's crazy stuff. You know, it's kind of like we're heading into William Gibson's world here, as all of these little bits of...
A la Neuromancer.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. A la Neuromancer, a la Johnny Mnemonic, you know?
I don't know. I wonder if within our lifetime this will almost be, like, take some shape where it's... you know, the norm and in vogue or something.
Well, now don't hold me to it, but I want to say that Gibson's general setting was usually like mid 21st century, and we're at the start of the 21st century here, so I think we're kind of en route here. I don't know. I don't know whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, or maybe it's a little bit of both. I know that in a number of his stories, it was actually fashionable to have certain implants. For example, to have artificial eyesight was fashionable.
Yeah.
And what you would do is you'd look into somebody's eyes and you'd see right down across the bottom of the iris, you'd see Zeiss icon. You know?
Well, I mean. With the way that cell phones have become such a status symbol, I'm sure it's just around the corner. It's almost like halfway between having the coolest cell phone and, you know, having plastic surgery, like a merge between the two.
Yeah, I hear you on that one. Actually, here's an interesting one on cell phones. People are taking their cell phones, since the phone itself has now become such a ubiquitous thing. People have started to take their cell phones and trick them out in various ways. You know, they've got phones that have got changeable faceplates and things like that. Well, the latest one is these antennas. You unscrew the antenna that comes with your cell phone, and in its place, you put one that's got an LED on the top of it. And as you're talking, the LED flashes.
It actually modulates with your voice?
No, it doesn't modulate with your voice. It just runs off of the raw radio wave and flashes. But the problem is that the FCC has come down on these things and basically tagged them as contraband, because they're apparently making enough of a modification to the radio wave in the effort of tapping into the radio wave that they are interfering with the adjacent public service band.
So they're way out of compliance on that one.
Exactly. Exactly.
Briefly, that almost reminds me of another story I meant to bring with me and I neglected. And that was that someone discovered a way to use on certain devices, whether they be routers or modems or such, where there is a visible LED that modulates in time with the data. He actually found a way to extract the data.
I saw that
with a telescope or some other optical device.
I saw that article. What'd they do? How far did they get? Like 10 megabaud, I think, was as high as they were able to get with it.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if one military or another already knew about this technology.
I'll say this about that. I don't know about trying it with routers or switches or such. Actually, I'm pretty sure most modern switches you wouldn't be able to do it with, because they seem to have a buffer behind the LED so that it actually holds it on for a length of time that's visible, even for the smallest packet.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, back in the days of modems, you know, I say it like they're a thing of the past. There's still places in the world where that's the only way to get to the internet. But, you know, in the
not
days...
in the heartland.
In the days of the modem, there was... One of my observations was that the send and receive lights never really shone full brightness.
Yeah.
And my take on it was, especially since the fact that they would run dimmer if you upped the DTE speed on the modem.
Uh-huh.
Even if you were running the same speed over the phone line, if you upped the DTE speed, they would shine dimmer. My take on it was that they just tied into the send and receive lines on the serial port and brought that forward to the LED. So of course it's going to modulate on that. All you've got to do is point the appropriate device at it and pick it off.
Oy.
Yeah, exactly. It's a scary thought. Well, we're up on our up onto our first break here. You're listening to 91.5 FM WRPI. The show is Little Brother, and we'll be back in just... And you are listening to 91.5 FM WRPI in Troy. It's time now for us to tell you what's going on after dark. Let's see, at the Ale House, 680 River Street, Troy, Saturday night they're having Not Working playing. The All Sports Pub at River and State Streets in Troy, Wednesday night karaoke with Mark the Shark. Artie's Lansingburg Station at 606 2nd Avenue in Troy. Let's see, Saturday night, Big Johnson Blues Band. That'd be tonight, of course. Augie's Route 9W Kukasaki. Tonight, Larry Lewis and Solid Smoke Rhythm and Blues Band. At Barcelona, 1192 Western Avenue, Albany. Let's see here. Tonight, Abby Biaz, flamenco guitar. And that's just a sampling of the things that are going on after dark.
And don't
here
forget
in the Great Capital District. What?
Oh, and then there's always there's a big fondue party at my friend Sven. I'm just kidding.
The show is Little Brother. The topic is technology. My name is Chuck Ritter. Fongaboo is sitting across the room from me here.
Hey, hey.
The phone number is 518-276-6248. If you want to throw in your 2 cents worth, it is welcome. If you don't want to put your voice on the air, you can send us email. Email address is critter@verizoneatspoop.com. That's critter, C-R-I-T-T-E-R, at verizoneatspoop, all one word, .com. And last but not least, you can send me snail mail at Chuck Ritter, care of WRPI, Box 31, 1 WRPI Plaza, Troy, New York, 12180. And let me say that again slowly because I just said that way too fast. Chuck Ritter, care of WRPI, Box 31, 1 WRPI Plaza, Troy, New York, 12180. And the opinions and views expressed in this program are strictly those of the participants, not necessarily those of Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, the Rensselaer Student Union, or the WRPI staff or management. Responsible parties with an opposing viewpoint may request airtime for a rebuttal. Again, the number 518-276-6248, and we'd love to hear from you.
So, I think there's, like I said, another big week for cybernetics, still staying in the primate region. Do you want to tell us our...
Well, I think I want to just take a quick second and also point out that the discussion that we had a little earlier, it did catch the attention of one of our listeners.
Oh.
And I'd like to appreciate that person listening. The discussion of artificial eyes, Zeiss Icon eyes, that is fiction. That is out of William Gibson's work, and it's basically the reason why we brought it up is that we feel that that's the, or at least I feel, I don't know if you feel that way or not, but is the general direction that society is headed in if cybernetics continue to grow at the rate that they're currently growing.
It's good to get some feedback from callers.
It's always great.
As Carl Sagan always said, for every caller you get, there are billions and billions of listeners.
Well, I think he may have exaggerated on that one. But that's good. That's good. Let's see here. A monkey with a fingernail-sized brain implant moved a cursor on a computer screen just by thinking. Mm. The latest in a series of experiments that have raised hopes that paralyzed people might one day be able to control complex devices with their minds. Ooh. Mm. While humans have already been implanted with a similar device that allows control of a cursor, the set of thin wires used by Brown University's researchers is less bulky and worked by measuring fewer neurons. Three rhesus monkeys were given the implants, which were first used to record signals from their motor cortex, an area of the brain that controls movement, as they manipulated a joystick with their hands. Then those signals were used to develop a program that enabled one of the monkeys to continue moving the cursor with its brain. During dozens of trials over several months, the monkey moved the cursor just by thinking and used it to touch dots that appeared on the screen, earning orange juice as a reward. Boy, these guys are cheap.
What reward did Kevin Warwick get?
I don't know.
That's what I'm wondering.
I don't know. Let's see. The results are promising enough that the device could one day be used on humans, the researchers reported in Thursday's issue of the Journal of Nature. They would not speculate on how long that might take. I should say this, by the way, came out of the Washington Post.
Mm-hmm. And we should probably already know. Also note the Kevin Warwick story is courtesy of CNN. I don't know. I'm almost smelling like man versus monkey pay-per-view cyborg battle. You know.
Okay. Okay.
It's right around the corner.
Well, the thing about it. Oh, hey, check it out.
What?
The phone's ringing.
Really? Is it the monkey?
I don't know. Let's find out. Hello, caller. Are you there?
Yes, I am. I just have one question.
Go right ahead.
If I can move the cursor with my brain, do I get orange juice?
You know, that's a good question. That was worth it.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. We're on a low budget. Tang, maybe?
Let's see. I don't know. We might have to settle for some lemonade on that one. You know, get as much water into it as we can get away with.
So, although it's been a big week for cyborgs, it's been a fun month for Microsoft once again.
Oh, boy.
First up, 25 states unite to fight Microsoft Motion. In three separate legal briefs filed Friday, a total of 34 states opposed a Microsoft Motion that a federal judge should dismiss the remaining portion of its antitrust case. Nine states and the District of Columbia returned to court Monday to determine a remedy for the company's antitrust violations, but Microsoft has asked U.S. District Judge Colleen Coller-Cotelli to dismiss the state's litigation, arguing that the state should not be allowed to set antitrust policy over the Justice Department. The Justice Department and nine other states settled the case in November. 25 additional states rallied Friday behind the nine litigating states: California, Connecticut, Florida, Iowa, Kansas, Massachusetts, Minnesota, Utah, and West Virginia, along with the District of Columbia, in an attempt to protect states' jurisdiction over antitrust matters. 24 of those additional states filed a joint brief saying that they, quote, take no position in this memorandum on the merits of the underlying antitrust case. New York filed a separate brief. The nine litigating states filed a brief of their own. In their brief, the 24 states argued that the Clayton Act grants them the authority to continue a case even when the federal government has proposed to settle a case. Congress has granted the states clear authority to proceed independently under Section 16, despite the fact that the federal government has chosen not to act, has proposed to settle a case, has in fact settled a case, or has taken the matter to trial. New York raised similar concerns. Quote, "We have strong relationships with many of the state attorneys general," said Microsoft spokesman Jim Dessler. Quote, "We work with them on various activities and initiatives. On this issue, we agree to disagree. While the states do have a role in antitrust enforcement, the non-settling states stepped outside the boundaries of that role when they chose to pursue a different course from the Justice Department, resulting in conflicting national competition policy." So basically, they're trying to weasel out of.
And this comes as a surprise? Of course they're going to try to weasel out of it.
But obviously, you know, there are still plenty of people concerned at the imbalance of power in the hands of Microsoft.
Exactly.
And another one of them is Sun Microsystems.
Yeah, well, Sun Microsystems and Microsoft have been at odds with each other for quite some time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's primary reason why Sun has produced their own counterpart to Microsoft Office.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they want to be able to put their computers out there without having to have any dealings with Microsoft if they can possibly get away with it.
But Sun did file suit against Microsoft this month for antitrust violations.
Really?
This coming from. I lost the sheet with my attribute. I believe this came from CNET. Actually, I could be wrong. This actually might be a press release from Sun.
Okay.
At this point, I make no definite claim, but I'll share what we have. Sun Microsystems announced it has filed a private antitrust lawsuit against Microsoft Corporation. The suit, filed in the United States District Court in San Jose, seeks remedies for the harm inflicted by Microsoft's anti-competitive behavior with respect to the Java platform, and for damages resulting from Microsoft's illegal efforts to maintain and expand its monopoly power. In June 2001, the Federal Court of Appeals found Microsoft guilty of legally abusing its monopoly power with respect to Sun and the Java platform.
Okay, this sounds familiar now.
Mm.
Because...
Yeah, they've complained about this in the past. But.
And Microsoft have basically gone in and created a version of the of the Java platform, which should not be allowed to bear the Sun's trademark Java.
Botched is a good
not
word.
Java.
Botched is a good term that comes to my mind.
It's Javoid. it's decaf.
It's
that's
Javesque.
It's decaf.
Java-like. It's Java-y.
It's Javish.
Sun suit seeks redress for the competition and economic harm caused by Microsoft's illegal acts. Quote, after careful consideration, Sun filed this suit in order to uphold its fiduciary. I don't even know that word. Fiduciary?
I'm going to have to look that one up. I've heard it.
I'm embarrassed. But uphold its fiduciary responsibilities to its shareholders and employees, said Michael Morris, Senior Vice President and General Counsel of Sun Microsystems. Quote, this private antitrust lawsuit is intended to restore competition in the marketplace by removing unlawful barriers to the distribution of the Java platform and to interoperability between Microsoft software and competitive technologies. The achievement of these goals will allow for greater innovation and increased customer choice. Now, I think... Didn't they in releasing Internet Explorer 6, didn't Microsoft make a bold move in completely removing Java from the...
They may have done. I've tried
from
to
the browser.
I've tried to keep my distance from Internet Explorer.
Myself included. It's kind of...
I mean, I've even dropped Netscape as of late.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I'm running something that's like a second cousin to Netscape.
Just a straight up
Mozilla.
Mozilla?
Yeah, exactly. Okay.
But
it seems to be more stable.
I don't know. That's a bold move. I think this was in parallel with the fact that they were trying to assert ActiveX as sort of an overriding standard, you know, surprise, surprise.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Microsoft is basically in the business of establishing standards so that they can close everybody else out of them.
I think they'd rewrite the laws of physics if they could.
You kind of change the laws of physics. I'm sorry, I couldn't resist that one.
I was joking with a fellow admin this week. What did I say? I love how not only do they try to override standards, but they like blatantly botch the nomenclature for things. I said, right after I log into my Microsoft Post Office, I'm going to publish a web.
Yeah, right. I'll tell you where it started, too. It started with Microsoft Domains.
Don't even get me started. You don't even want to know.
There was a place I worked where we had a guy who had never seen Windows NT in action at all.
Mm-hmm.
And he was suddenly charged with the task of getting a Windows NT server, the first one in the company, up and running.
Uh-huh.
He's from a Unix world. Everything else in the entire company is Unix.
Okay.
And so what is he set up as the domain? Well, duh, insert the name of the company here, .com.
Uh-huh.
You know?
Well,
not realizing that wasn't what they what the machine wanted.
You don't even want to get me started because myself, being a name server administrator, there's at my place of employment, there's been a couple meetings recently regarding one particular server, which happens to be both a traditional domain name server, you know, running, it's not running Bind because it's an NT machine.
Right.
But, you know, the equivalent name resolution
mechanism.
Services. But it also happens to be a Microsoft domain controller for an internal network. So while discussing the fate of this machine, you can imagine the who's on first type Abbott and Costello conversations and discussions that go on in these meetings.
Yes, and the sound that you all may have just heard was me hitting my head repeatedly against the microphone in response to that one.
One other notable Microsoft story. Microsoft sues Linux startup over name.
Oh, I know which one this would be. This would be Lindows.
Yes, yes. I this is my first learning about Lindows, actually. This comes from CNET. The Redmond-based software giant Microsoft, what other one would there be, filed a motion with the U.S. Court for the Western District of Washington against Lindows, which is developing a version of the Linux operating system that will run popular applications written for Microsoft's Windows OS. Microsoft contends the company, which plans to formally release its product next year, purposely is trying to confuse Lindows with Windows. The suit asks the court, and they're not trying to confuse domains with domains.
Right. Now, I kind of object to this particular objection. Objection, Your Honor. Okay.
Overruled. No, go ahead.
Fine. Be that way. The way I see it, you know, I don't see it as an attempt to confuse the buyer that they're, you know, that they're getting something other than Windows. I mean, I think your average American can tell the difference between an L and a W. If they don't, they can't, they should not be picking up computer software to begin with.
Uh-huh.
And it's more kind of like driving the point home that this is something that is a viable substitute for Windows.
Uh-huh. So, and by the same token, I guess restaurants offering brunch should be charged with false advertising.
I suppose you could do that. Not to mention, we should probably go after Bisquick. Sounds too much like biscuit.
Microsoft contends... I'm sorry. The suit asks a court to order the startup to stop using the Lindows name and also asks unspecified monetary damages. Quote, "We're not asking the court to stop the company from making their products," said Microsoft spokesman John Murchison. Quote, "What we are saying is they should not use a name that could confuse the public and infringe on our valuable trademark." Lindows is based on the Wine Project, an open source effort to mimic the commands that Windows programs use.
It also makes Bill Gates do just exactly that.
The San Diego-based Lindows company was launched earlier this year by Michael Robertson, former CEO of digital music site MP3.com. Robertson characterized the move as a number attempt by Microsoft to thwart a viable threat to its Windows empire. Quote, "If they're alleging that people are going to be confusing Microsoft Corp with Lindows.com, I think there's zero potential of that happening. If people are confused, just remember that we're not the convicted monopolist."
That's a good way to keep them apart.
Murchison said Microsoft considered legal action as a last resort. Quote, "Clearly we prefer to work with them to resolve this problem voluntarily. Their product name infringes on our trademark. We hope they will work with us to resolve this problem without the need for legal action." Robertson said he had heard from nobody at Microsoft regarding the name dispute. Quote, "They just file lawsuits." Microsoft has been involved in an increasingly fractious war of words with Linux supporters this year, with Microsoft executives castigating the open source distribution model behind Linux as a sure road to commercial failure and on blight for software development. Emmett Stanton, an attorney at Palo Alto, California-based Fenwick & West, said Microsoft has not been overzealous in the past about protecting its trademark, allowing spoof sites and others to go unchallenged. Quote, "They're not the type to sue at the drop of a hat." Superficially, you would have to say...
Would that be a red hat?
Ah.
Ba-dum-boom.
Superficially, you would have to say there's some potential for confusion, and the defendant may be trying to trade on Microsoft's position in the marketplace. This actually brings to mind something that I've been kind of preaching, granted not on a on a wide broadcast venue of any sort for, but for a while, preaching. That
preach on.
The nature.
Sorry, Midwest got into me.
The nature of the Microsoft monopoly, I think, has been misunderstood. Whereas, like, so much has been focused on, like, browser bundling and all sorts of, you know, intimidation that Microsoft has made towards other companies, which, you know, is a valid complaint, but no one wants to take a look at the fact that the Microsoft desktop OS monopoly is built on the chicken or egg theory that basically the majority of people use Windows because that's what the majority of software is available for, and the majority of developers make software for Windows because that's the majority of installed user base.
Uh-huh.
And what keeps that secure for so many years is the physical obstruction that you, A, that you can't run binaries between platforms, especially, and which leads to B, that they keep under lock and key the source that would be necessary to make this possible.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
absolutely.
You know, I wish, you know, the Justice Department and even people like Ralph Nader would take note of this important fact, because I didn't see it raised during any of the trial or hardly mentioned at all, when that's really the crux of things, is that, you know, maybe they made some good decisions in the beginning of things, but once they got established in this chicken or the egg routine, they were pretty much locked in, and no one else has a hope of making another operating system on, you know, that can compete. Imagine, if you will, a
presented for your consideration.
Imagine, if you will, a world where you could, at least to some degree of reliability, run any application on any OS that you wanted, and therefore people chose OSs by merely on the lauds of its features and reliability.
Exactly. And I think that if you got to that particular point, the choice between Windows and Linux would be features versus reliability.
Yeah.
Because Windows is a beautiful thing to look at.
Yeah.
It looks very nice. It's fairly responsive to you, mm-hmm. but it crashes a lot. Linux, on the other hand, is rock solid.
Mm-hmm.
Let's put it this way. Linux is like a deuce and a half military truck.
Mm-hmm.
You can't kill it, but it's not
Humvee.
Pretty. You know, it's rock solid, but
yeah,
it's just not pretty.
I believe that. I could be wrong, but I think that I had seen that in addition to Windows being a Linux distribution with Wine, you know, installed ready to go, I think it also comes with a Windows-esque Windows manager for Linux.
That wouldn't surprise me. There has been one for some years now.
Mm-hmm.
There was one called FVWM95 that came out about 96, 97. It was an imitation. It was actually a very good imitation of the Windows start button taskbar configuration.
Mm-hmm. But based on the principles that I laid forth here, I think that Windows could potentially be a pivotal product, because, you know, although Wine has existed for quite some time, and you know, it's Windows is nothing much more than just Linux and Wine. Someone offering the two together as a turnkey product that could potentially just be installed by an average consumer, I think that's going to be a precedent.
That's true. Actually, when you think about it, it's actually more ideal, because in addition to running Windows executables, you can run Linux executables on it. Mm-hmm. Now, you can't say that about Windows. You can almost say that about Windows. There's two packages you have to install on Windows to make it happen.
Yeah.
You have to install Cygnus, or actually one or the other, I should say. You have to either install Cygnus or you have to install Line.
Now, let me ask you something that I think you might have some more expertise on than I.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a question I've had for quite some time. And that is, if Microsoft were made to either make available, if they were to make available either through licensing or otherwise, the source code to Windows,
mm-hmm.
could something like Wine or just the plain ability to run Windows applications on their other OSs, would that become more of a reality and would systems like Wine be even more robust and reliable?
Well,
if
sure,
it didn't have to be backwards engineered.
If you went through the source code to Windows, of course, you'd be able to see how it was actually put together without having to poke it in various places and see how it responds.
With that conclusion, that almost drives me to want to petition the parties that be, whether it be the Justice Department or a third party activist like Ralph Nader, to point out this important logistic that non-technical people aren't technically adept are not familiar with, and perhaps the monopoly of Microsoft should be re-examined again based on this fact, which I believe is the crux.
Yeah, I know you can't hear me nodding my head over here, but I don't know. It actually strikes me as this idea of running an executable across different platforms really kind of reminds me of my original platform of choice from years ago, and that was the Amiga.
Yeah.
Amen.
And I think most people. You walk up to them and you talk to them about the Amiga, and they never heard of it. It's disappeared into history, which is unfortunate. But this particular platform was based on the same chipsets the same processor chip that the Macintosh is based on,
mm-hmm.
Which is different from what the PC is based on. But you could get two cards and insert them into an Amiga. One was called an implant, and the other was called a bridge board.
Yeah.
And the implant was a Macintosh emulator, and the bridge board was a PC emulator. And when you get the two of them in there, you had one computer that could run Amiga software, Macintosh software, and PC software. And the best part was it could run them all at once.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And this... It was the lesser known platform, unfortunately, and I think that's really what we're looking at right now with Linux and Wine. It's the lesser known platform. It's Linux, but it'll run Windows executables with a little bit of if you speak to it sweetly.
But I mean, I'm almost imagining a world where the source code is available through licensing, and where we would have a choice of even more, like five or six different OSs we could choose, ones that were geared towards, the type of work that we do. It used to be like that. And I think it's just, it's not possible. Linux is great, but for myself, someone with the type of applications I do, I have no choice but to use Windows because
you're doing video.
The video and multimedia apps, I mean the Macintosh is a fair contender in those areas, but I don't know. I don't like Mac that much that I would switch over.
Alrighty. Well, we need to take a quick break here for a public service announcement. Little Brother will be right back after this. You are listening to 91.5 FM WRPI in Troy. We're going into our last half hour. The show is Little Brother. The topic is technology. The phone number is 518-276-6248. My name is Chuck Ritter. Fongaboo sitting across the room from me here.
Wow.
And We are taking your calls, but before we do, we'll remind you that the opinions and views expressed in this program are strictly those of the participants, not necessarily those of Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, the Rensselaer Student Union, or the WRPI staff or management. Take it away.
I just wanted to follow up what we were discussing before the break. In contrast, you know, I was pointing out about how I felt during the Microsoft antitrust case. A lot of focus was being paid attention to concerns that really didn't get to the heart of the Microsoft monopoly. And like, I'll contrast by pointing out browser bundling. People, you know, a lot of the case was made that it was anti-competitive to include Internet Explorer with Windows because it gave an extra edge to them over manufacturers of other browsers like Netscape or Opera.
Of course, the problem is that Netscape and Mozilla and Galleon are all and Lynx are all bundled with Linux. So
yeah, and furthermore, I think people were missing the point with that because, I mean, if you're going to go by that, how about, let's say, a robust text editor for Windows, such as Ultra Edit? Wouldn't they have the same case against against bundling Notepad with Windows?
Yeah.
So I think people were missing the point. There needs to be an environment where other OSs can be released in some kind of practical way that people have a choice to choose another OS without throwing out all of their old applications. And then, you know, each OS can bundle the browser of their particular preference with that OS. The OS is where the choice has to be available, and it's not available to consumers.
Yeah, that's true.
You know?
And I'll tell you another thing, too. In general, I'm not a big fan of antitrust suits. I recognize that they are occasionally necessary, but I have a fundamentally libertarian core, mm-hmm. and it kind of strikes at that core when you talk about antitrust suits. But I think that a much bigger case could have been made against Microsoft simply for the merchantability of their goods.
Hmm. How so?
Well, would you voluntarily, if you had a choice, would you voluntarily buy an operating system that crashes daily?
True.
Okay. Would you buy a server operating system that requires you to reboot it once a week because it has a memory leak?
No.
Okay. I rest my case.
Yes. But it all comes back to, you know, there's almost this practical necessity to run Windows because you got to run with the pack. You know, there are these beautiful applications out there that you want to run, and you can't run it on anything else other than this. There's no impetus that's allowing the developers to viably develop it for something else.
And actually, that you said beautiful, and that kind of brings up another one of my pet peeves, and that's that the average consumer is more drawn to the flash of a good application, mm-hmm. Is more drawn to the flash of an application than to its solidity. And that really is one of the things that has made Windows prevalent, mm-hmm. over its competing operating systems.
But to act as an armchair economist for a moment, you know, I almost think that antitrust suits are important in such cases that, the benefits of capitalism and competition are being overridden or cheated. And I think they are here because they're exploiting, you know, obstructions and inertia,
yeah.
rather than creating a good product that has become the most widely used because it's the best, and it's that, which is not the case. Now, I have one other point I wanted to examine, and if I could pick your brain one more time.
Okay.
You know, I noted that the major blockage for that's preventing other operating systems from competing is the logistical boundary regarding binaries, running applications mm-hmm. across different platforms. A similar situation exists with drivers, I would say.
Well, sure.
Would you, so
I mean, at the present point in time, if you want to put out a hardware product, you have to put out a driver for Windows NT and a driver for Windows 95 and sometimes a driver for DOS and a driver for Linux and a driver for this and a driver for that and a driver for the other thing.
Mm. Now,
depending on how many platforms you want to support. And this is most prevalent in the field of network cards.
Now, if the Microsoft source code was more freely available, how much easier would that make an OS developer's job in providing stock drivers for existing popular hardware that's already out there to be fully functional in a new OS offering?
I don't think that would make that big of a difference.
No,
I could be wrong, and I'm sure other people have got opposing opinions to that. Mm-hmm. But I don't honestly think it would make that big of a difference because theoretically, anyway, Microsoft is going to want to be able to have their software run as much physical hardware as humanly possible.
Mm-hmm.
And along those lines, they're going to have well-documented, well-published APIs for accomplishing that task.
Yeah.
Now, whether or not hardware manufacturers are paying license fees to Microsoft, they probably are, for this privilege, I don't know.
Yeah. So it's more that's more of a burden that will still stick regardless of Microsoft actions.
I think so.
Okay.
Although it would be nice to have a standard to have some sort of a standardized set of handles you could use there.
Yeah. Almost like a Java for hardware.
Yeah.
That would be great. Would it create overhead the way Java does?
Oh yeah. Undoubtedly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But hey, we're already misusing gobs and gobs of RAM and processor cycles for needlessly anyway, running Windows, so hey, we're used to it.
So, well, let's see here. A few years back there was a big flap on the internet over the Church of Scientology. Some folks dared to criticize the aforementioned church. Of course, got their various portions of their anatomy sued off in the effort. And you kind of would expect that this would have gone by the wayside in the intervening years between then and now. But sure enough, it has surfaced again. This time in a victory for free speech. Google Inc. restored a website critical of the Church of Scientology on its internet search engine on Thursday, while free speech advocates slammed the company for removing the site in the first place. Google said the company had only removed certain pages from the site because of a copyright dispute, and that was actually how they shut it down before. It was based on copyright. Certain pages of the Xenu.net website were removed from the search engine earlier in the week in response to copyright infringement notices and notices of violation of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. Our buddy. said Google spokesman David Crane in an email.
Is that David Crane? Pitfall?
It could be. The homepage for Xenu.net was inadvertently removed, along with a long two-page list of associated web pages on Wednesday, but was restored by Thursday, said Google spokeswoman Cindy McCaffrey. Neither she nor Crane were available for further comment. On Thursday evening, the website was listed fourth under Google search results for Scientology and eighth under Church of Scientology. A lawyer representing the Church of Scientology accused Xenu.net of wholesale verbatim copyright infringement by allegedly reprinting a lot of material on the site.
This kind of precedent scares me because, you know, I cringe enough as it is every time I hear suggestions that ISPs are going to be held responsible for content that their users publish to their servers.
Well, I'll tell you what else, you know. I think this is kind of an abuse of copyright because, I mean, I would think that if you were going to be talking about religious materials, the only copyright that should appear on them should be should say something like copyright 5000 BC by God, all rights reserved. for a so-called church to then turn around for a so-called church to turn around, and this is strictly my opinion, and just so that everybody knows where I'm coming from on this, I am an agnostic.
Mm-hmm.
But it
right on.
It's strictly my opinion that materials published by a church that are supposed to be guiding you to the way to eternal salvation should not be copyrighted. This is something that you. This is wealth that you should be spreading.
Mm-hmm. And should it be on the bestseller list?
I don't know about that. Yeah. I don't know about that.
And it still manages to get there year after year, supposedly because masses of books are purchased and repurchased and returned.
Yeah,
supposedly. But did I follow this correctly? That this was pressure on a search engine to pull listing.
Yeah.
That really makes me cringe. That really scares me because, I mean...
Well, the good news, though, is that it set a precedent, and the precedent is that you can't do that.
I mean, you're just merely providing a guide to what's out there. Even though they provide, like, a web gash, which might provide a little bit more of an argument, it's merely, a history or a facsimile of what's out there on the web. You're not... It is there. We're not. They shouldn't have to lie about its existence.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know.
Some people. So, in another area of constraint in the digital world, this coming from CNET's article asked the question, is hardware key to piracy crackdown? Software alone can't stop digital piracy, researchers said this week, emphasizing that only a totally secured infrastructure has a chance to eliminate the problem. The recommendations come as opposition builds against a proposed bill that would force hardware makers to add anti-copying features to MP3 players and other devices. Although legislators and device makers both see a need for a hardware solution to securing digital content, the groups are at odds over the government's efforts to regulate such technology. Quote, every single device has to be secure, said Darko Kervosky, a researcher studying watermarking and security technologies at Microsoft Research. Quote, if one device is not secure, then this digital content protection does not work. Kervosky's comments underscore the enormous difficulties facing the consumer electronics and entertainment industries, which have been struggling for years to agree on anti-piracy standards. Now a legislative backlash against hardware makers is gathering force that could further polarize the two sides. On Thursday, Senator Ernest Fritz Hollings introduced the Consumer Broadband and Digital Television Promotion Act, which mandates that devices handling digital content have an industry-standard means of protecting that content from piracy. Previously known as the Security System Standards and Certification Act, the draft legislation had been widely criticized. I think the name of this act is a bit more hip, you know?
What was the name again?
The Consumer Broadband and Digital Television Promotion Act. Which was previously the Security System Standards and Certification.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. Well, I'll tell you something. At least they've changed the name of the act so it sort of more closely mirrors what it actually does.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the problem with it before was they made it sound like it was actually a good thing.
Yeah.
You know. But yeah, I remember talking to this a couple of weeks ago, and my particular concern was that I'm afraid that if this thing becomes law, Linux will become illegal.
Really? Why?
Because the fact that the only way I could think of, there were only a few ways I could think of to make this happen, and the only one that didn't involve an enormous amount of overhead was to have your hard drive have an encryption key in it. Mm-hmm. And in order to have the matching encryption key, you had to have your software certified. Well, okay, great. Let's say you get some version of Linux certified, but Linux is open source. You must be able to have the source code, or it's not a legal distribution of Linux. And if you've got the source code, all you've got to do is snip out the parts that that secure the system while not snipping out the parts that open up the encryption, and wham-bam, you now have a you now have an illegal operating system. And I pledged at that time, and I will repeat my pledge at this point in time, if the Linux operating system should become illegal, I pledge to engage in civil disobedience.
Ah. Well, funny you should mention that. Wired this week also had something to say about the CBTTPA. That sounds almost like better also, kind of like KFC versus Kentucky Fried Chicken, you know? You know, I don't have time to say all those words, but...
24-hour banking? I haven't got time for that. Credit to Stephen Wright for that one, of course.
But Wired was noting how the CBDTPA will affect coders, and especially open-source coders. America's programmers, engineers, and sundry bitheads have not yet figured out how much a new copyright bill will affect their livelihood. When they do, watch for an angry million geek march to storm Capitol Hill.
I'm on it. I'm there.
Except, I don't know, a lot of us privacy rights activists among the geek population may not show up with all the cameras that are going to be around.
You gotta pick your battles, man. It's just as simple as that.
Yeah, but just don't pick your nose because you're on camera. A bill introduced this week by Senator Fritz Hollings would roll the electronics industry by forcibly would roil, sorry, the electronics industry by forcibly embedding copyright protection into digital devices from MP3 players to cell phones to fax machines, digital cameras, and personal computers. But the CBDTPA would also wreak havoc on programmers and software
companies.
Try saying
that when you're not stone-cold sober. CBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTBTB
The CBDTPA would also
I had to open my mouth, didn't I?
The CBDTPA would also wreak havoc on programmers and software companies, both those distributing code for free and those selling it. No more than 2 years and 7 months after the bill becomes law, the only code programmers and software firms will be able to... Yeah. Did they miss a word here? No more than 2 years and 7 months after the bill becomes law, the only code programmers and software firms that will be able to distribute must have copy protection schemes approved by the federal government. To put this in perspective, the CBDTPA would, if enacted in its current form, have the electrifying effect on computer professionals that the Supreme Court's decision in Bush versus Gore did to the Democratic Party members. Legal experts said on Friday that the CBDTPA represents or regulates nearly any program in source or object code that runs on a PC or anything else with a microprocessor. That's not just Windows media players and their brethren, as you might expect. The CBDTPA's sweeping definition of, quote, any hardware or software includes word processors, spreadsheets, operating systems, compilers, programming languages, all the way down to the humble Unix utilities like CP and CAT.
Unbelievable.
Quote, the definition will cover just about anything that runs on your computer, except maybe the clock, said Tom Bell, a professor at Chapman University School of Law. Then Bell paused for a moment and reconsidered. Quote, there's a risk you could say it covers things like your clock. According to the CBDTPA, any software with the ability to reproduce copyrighted works may not... Yeah, is time copyrighted?
The time is now 6:54 and 56 seconds p.m. Copyright 2002, C.J. Ritter.
But I don't know. Wrapping this up, I think you know we're getting the point of how the hatches are being battened down in almost ridiculous proportions. But there was a good quote I wanted to find in this article. But basically, I'd like to attribute who actually said it.
But, yeah.
I can't find it, but I'm going to paraphrase. Basically, you know, if we take everyone and put them into solitary confinement, then there'll be no murder. And that's basically what the, these attempts at hardware hardware restrictions.
That's true. The assumption is the customer is always wrong. The customer is a liar, a cheat, and a thief.
Yeah.
And
guilty until proven
and no other industry can get away with that. Let's see here. Before I read this next one real quick, I'm going to give the abbreviated version, of course, because we are coming up against the clock here. Mm-hmm. But before I read it, I'm going to make one quick note, and that is that I am a strong believer in the fact that if you are going to name a place in a conversation or in a discussion, you should pronounce it the way the natives pronounce it.
Mm,
so with that in mind, in Boston, about 10,000 people a week go to the Rack, a bar in Boston favored by sports stars, including members of New England Patriots. One by one, they hand over their driver's licenses to a doorman who swipes them through a sleek black machine. If a license is valid and its holder is over 21, a red light blinks and the patron is waved through. Shouldn't it be a green light?
Hmm. Our security system at my job is actually reversed like that.
Weird. But most ours blinks green when your card is good, and it blinks yellow when it's bad, and it sits green when it's otherwise, when it's waiting, you know. But most of the customers are not aware that it also pulls the name, address, birth date, and other personal details from a data strip on the back of the license.
Beautiful.
Even height, eye color, and sometimes social security number are registered. You swipe the license, and all of a sudden, someone's whole life as we know it pops up in front of you, says Paul Barkley, the bar's owner. It's almost voyeuristic. Mr. Barkley bought the machine to keep out underage drinkers who use fake IDs, but he soon found that he could build a database of personal information providing an intimate perspective on his clientele that can be useful in marketing. It's not just an ID check, he said. It's a tool. Mm. Sure it is. Now, for any given night or hour, he can break down his clientele by sex, age, zip code, or other characteristics. If he wanted to, he could find out how many blonde women named Karen over 5'2" came in for a weekend, or how many of his customers have the middle initial M.
He's not just a bouncer, he's a tool.
More practically, he can build mailing lists based on all that data and keep track of who comes back.
Oof.
You know, this is scary. This is some scary stuff.
Yeah. Weird, wild.
Yeah, really.
Yes, it is, sir.
I mean, this is more information than they ought to be keeping track of. And I really think that we were having a discussion on this one before we came into the studio.
Mm-hmm.
And our intrepid transmitter engineer here at the station was in the discussion. He pointed out to us that that in New York State such a setup would be illegal. Now, I don't
know. Under some title or another that I plan to research.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll come back with that one next week, I think.
But I plan to, if that being the case, if I, you know, ever if I ever enter such a place of business where swiping is the common practice at the door, I think I'll carry a copy of said title.
It's Article 75.
Article
75. Thank you.
Of what?
State alcohol code.
Not of Dianetics.
What's that?
The alcohol control something.
Mm-hmm. and that's straight from our intrepid transmitter engineer's mouth.
On page 74 of Dianetics.
Well, we are coming up against the clock here, so I think we're going to have to wrap it up for another week here.
Yeah.
Yeah, you've been listening to Little Brother episode 38 for March 23rd, 2002.
It's been frisky.
And we will be back next week. So tune in then. You're listening to 91.5 FM WRPI Troy.
Thank you.